Tonight on the All Kinds Weather Forecast, the Florida Gators have their first kickoff time of the season. We preview the softball NCAA tournament, and we take a look at what the baseball season is looking like as it comes to a conclusion. This is the All Kinds Weather Forecast. And welcome in to another episode. I am your host, Chris Yane, alongside my co-host, Neil Shulman, here in the heart of Gator Nation. Today is May 14th, 2024, and we are excited to bring you another episode tonight. We've got some big news tonight regarding football and the football season schedule, as we finally have our first kickoff time of the season. And let me just say, it is going to be a hot one in the swamp. And we're also going to get into stickball here, softball and baseball. Both seasons are nearing its conclusion, but both seasons are going in totally opposite directions. So we will get to all that. But before we do so, please like and subscribe. If you're watching on YouTube, leave a comment down below and tell us how we're doing. It really helps us reach all of Gator Nation and bring you great content. Also, if you'd like to listen in audio format, please listen to us on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star rating. Helps us also reach all of our listeners. So, Neil, the Florida Gators and the Miami Hurricanes will kick off in a familiar time slot. A lot of Gator fans over the decades came, they know all too well that 3:30 kickoff on CBS. However, this time the Gators and the Hurricanes will kick off 3:30 on ABC, as now the SEC on CBS is no more. We move to the ABC ESPN family. And it's going to be a hot one. This is going to be end of August, a kickoff against the Canes. And, you know, I got to think it's going to be a pretty hostile environment with the heat there, and certainly maybe an extra advantage for the Gators. But nonetheless, this could go down as one of the hottest games in school history, up there with the 2018 Colorado State game, where it was reported at the airport that it was real feel at 104 degrees. Other games of note was USF against South Florida in 2010 and Tennessee in 2003. So, Neil, how do we feel about this kickoff time? It is important to note that there is a slate of games all through ABC that day. Noon is going to actually be the Georgia Bulldogs kicking off against the Clemson Tigers. So, I don't think it has anything necessarily to do with who's the better team, because if it was for that primetime slot, because if it was, you would think Georgia and Clemson would actually get it, but they're actually kicking off at noon. The Gators and the Canes are at 3:30, and Texas A&M and Notre Dame actually got the primetime slot at 7:30. So, you know, Neil, what are your thoughts thus far on the 3:30 kickoff?
Well, a few thoughts. Number one, I absolutely loathe what money, and specifically TV money, is doing to college football. First with the conference realignments, and now making all the big games at noon. I mean, Fox already had its big noon kickoff, but now it looks like ABC and ESPN are looking to sort of compete with that by putting Georgia Clemson there, which, I mean, Texas Notre Dame, there's no way that belongs at night. There's no way that should be the night game over Georgia Clemson. Granted, it is more of a national game, and Clemson Georgia is regional. I think those two schools are only like 90, 100 miles apart or so. But I mean, come on, those two teams are much more nationally relevant, even with how Clemson has fallen off, than Notre Dame and Texas A&M have been over the last decade. So that's the first thing. Second thing, I hope that ESPN and ABC come up with a new theme music, because us losing the SEC on CBS is definitely going to sting. It's definitely going to feel weird when you see like Bloomington, Indiana get panned over by the CBS camera for Indiana Rutgers game, and you hear that. Dun, 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 dun. That's
not going to hit the same.
No, and I hope we don't get flagged for copyright for me using that little humming of the tune right there, by the way. But yeah, that's going to feel weird. And then, yeah, I wish it was a night game, Florida-Miami, but I'm okay with 3:30. The Florida sideline's going to be in the shade, and the Miami sideline's just going to be roasting in the sun. So that's cool with me. I'll be on the Florida side, so that's, you know, fine. The only real downside that you may want to point to is the Florida fan base may not be quite as loud as it would be as it would for a night game, and it'll still be very, very loud, but night games are different, man. Night games in the swamp are just different. Like, there's a reason that we all want the games to be at night. And it's not necessarily just because of the convenience for us, but we know that the Swamp is just a little different at night. Now, like I said, it'll still be very, very loud. It's not going to be a meek or timid environment by any stretch. Just because the sun is still out doesn't mean the Gator fans don't know a big game when they see one. The other thing to keep note of too, aside from the heat and the humidity, is because this game is being played in Gainesville in August, it could easily get messed up by lightning. I mean, because that's happened multiple times. I mean, Western Kentucky in 07, that game actually ended early because of lightning. But they get score at 49-3. Florida's 2014 opener against Idaho got pushed back several times, got the opening kickoff in, got delayed again, and then canceled entirely. So that's also on the table. But we know something about the 2024 Gator football season, and that's exciting because it's May, and it makes the season feel like it's that much closer.
It's becoming real now. We are almost within 4 months of the opening kickoff against Miami. And, Neil, actually, it's funny you bring up that 2014 game. I was a senior in undergrad at University of Florida when that happened. And there was a lot of excitement going into that game just because it was kind of that make it or break it year for Muschamp. I think we all knew it going into year four. And the excitement of waiting hours and then Valdez showers in the showers of Gainesville that returned that kickoff nearly for a touchdown. And then we didn't even get the next playoff. It was pretty demoralizing, to say the least. You wait months and months and months for the opening kickoff, and then you have to wait an additional week before we play. I think it was Eastern Michigan the following week. It was very frustrating, and we lost a win. I mean, because Florida ended up finishing the season 6-5, we would have gotten the 7-5 mark. The record would have looked a little bit better had we had that game. So you're right. I didn't even think about the lightning aspect to this, because late August, chances are, you know, and God forbid, it's peak of hurricane season too. So there's a lot of things at play here, weather-wise.
And by the way, the lightning could happen regardless of the kickoff time. That's just something else to note on top of everything else. But I'm not blaming the 3:30 kickoff slot for that. Just, you know, could happen.
That's prime time in the afternoon in the state of Florida for an afternoon storm is around 3:30. So if it is delayed, it's delayed. And hopefully we'll get that kickoff in shortly thereafter. But, you know, I think it's just a message for the fans. You know, look, you're going to be tailgating all day. You were going to be tailgating regardless. Like, if it was a night game, that means you were going to be tailgating from sun up to sundown, and it still was going to be hot in the middle of the day. So you were going to be dealing with heat regardless of it was a 7:30 kickoff or a 3:30 kickoff. It's still going to be hot in Florida. And, you know, I think it just goes, you know, hydrate responsibly. Make sure you're drinking your electrolytes, your water during the game, and make, if you are drinking alcoholic beverages, adding some water in between those drinks so you can be able to make it to kickoff, because we definitely need you there loud and proud, you know, for the orange and blue. But I think it's exciting though. I mean, I like the 3:30 kickoff from a fan's perspective. And I mean, I live 2 hours. I know for you, Neil, it's different. You're out of state. For me, you know, I live 2 hours away in Tampa, so I could go up and back the same day, no problem. And for a lot of fans in a similar situation where they're within that 2 hour, maybe 3 hour radius of Gainesville, they have a similar luxury where they don't necessarily have to spend the money on a hotel. They can come in the day of, they can leave the same day and get home at a reasonable hour versus the 7:30 kickoff where you either got to make the decision of driving back late at night or getting a hotel and spending the money. So, you know, I kind of see both sides, but you know what, though? 3:30 kickoffs in the past have actually been really loud. I think back to that 2019 Auburn game, you know, and that was a 3:30 kickoff on CBS. And second play or third play of the game, we hit that slant or that post pattern to Freddie Swain. And, you know, say goodbye, Freddie. The crowd was nuts after that play. And honestly, the crowd throughout that entire game was bonkers. I mean, and then, of course, capped off by the P. Ryan run, 88 yards down the sideline to win that game for Florida. But the 3:30 kickoff, I think it holds a special place, at least in my heart growing up in the CBS SEC era. When I saw it, I was like, you know what? It is going to be hot. Would have loved a primetime game, but at least some tradition is still there for our schedule. And I'm sure we're going to get primetime games throughout the season, especially now that we're in the ESPN family. You know, before when we were more on CBS, if you were the game of the week, you were that 3:30 slot, so you had no shot at a primetime game. That's actually why some years Florida win without primetime games, because they were the game of the week. But now that we're in the ESPN family and they do the schedule a little bit differently, I think the chances of us getting a primetime game in the month of September throughout the season is still reasonably high. And this 3:30 kickoff, really, to me, I don't believe impacts the game any differently than you know, the storylines and the players and how the game goes.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way to talk about a Florida Miami game being less than fully packed to the brim, like some people we're talking about on Twitter. Like there's just no way that anyone can imagine that unless there's like a hurricane that barrels through the area like within 24 hours before and people physically can't get there. That's the only way I see this game not being packed. So I would have preferred it to be at night. It makes it easier for me travel wise, but I mean, it's Gator football. It's a rivalry that we don't play anymore. We don't know when we're going to ever see the Miami Hurricanes in the swamp again. So we're all going to be there cheering our lungs out for the Gators. I think that's a pretty safe conclusion. And it's a big game, Chris. Like I said, the Gator fan base knows a big game when it sees one. And even if you throw the rivalry aspect of it out, which is kind of hard to do, but let's just take it out for a second. It's a huge game for Florida.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this game is going to tell us how the season potentially could go, because if you lose it, you start 0-1, then all the murmurs about how this Gator team is going to have a losing record, they're not going to make a bowl game, it's going to conclude with the firing of Billy Napier. It becomes, the noise of that becomes deafening. But if you win that game, then you think, okay, we have momentum. We potentially have beaten a top 25 team. Miami is sort of getting that hype because of the arrival of Cam Ward at quarterback. Even though Florida returns one of the best veteran quarterbacks in all of college football, Miami's Cam Ward seems to be getting a lot more love and attention going into this game than Graham Mertz. You know, to me, I think it's kind of an untold story right now lying going into this game. But also Miami, a 2-point favorite as of right now, according to Vegas, some of the early lines came out for the season. Right now, Miami, a 2-point favorite. I got to like Florida's chances. And I actually went back when those lines did drop. Florida is essentially 500 in the last 15 years when they are a touchdown or less dog in the swamp. Most notably recently was the 2022 Utah game where Florida going into that was, I believe, a 4-point underdog. I might be getting that one wrong, but they were under a touchdown, ended up winning that game. And in the Napier era, Florida is 2-1 when they are a touchdown or less underdog. The lone loss coming last season to Florida State in the swamp, which, you know what, I think a lot of people believe we should have won that game. But Florida, I think, has an opportunity to continue that home field advantage. Last year against Tennessee, we were a touchdown underdog. Of course, went on to win that game by double digits. I think Florida fans are hoping for a similar result here for Miami. So this is a very important game to set the tone for the rest of the season as we go into SEC play very early on, as after Samford, we'll have Texas A&M, we'll go on the road to Mississippi State, and we'll get into the meat of it in October, as we'll talk about in later episodes. But you lose this game, Neil, and the noise will be deafening in Gainesville.
Yeah, that's a way to put it. I mean, to me, not only is this the biggest game of Napier's coaching career, I don't think there's even a close second. Maybe Tennessee last year, but I mean, we both know that the longer he's here and doesn't produce the results he's supposed to, the bigger that the pressure on him gets, the larger that target gets. And like you said last year, he has to stack wins early this year because the last five games of the season are just brutal. Second year in a row, we said that. Last year, we did stack some wins, clearly didn't stack enough wins early. And here's where I'll bring back the talking point I used from before the Arkansas game last year. I said this multiple times throughout that week leading up to the Arkansas game. There are two inflection point games that would dictate Napier's future at Florida. One, Arkansas this week. Two, Miami, August 31st, 2024. Well, he lost the first one. So look, you know, new season. I'm willing to let the past be the past if future results allow me to. And it's theoretically possible that Florida loses the season opener against Miami and miraculously wins the next 11 games to finish 11-1. But if we're just being realistic and we're just going to be objective here, Billy Napier cannot lose this game and expect to survive. And that's not a knee-jerk reaction of losing to a rival that everyone knows that I hate. It's because you're talking about a guy that in year one is 6-6, in year two is 5-7, and now he has a loss on his record right off the bat to begin his third year before facing that new look Texas A&M team, before he goes to Rocky Top, before he goes to Austin, Texas, before he faces the most dominant team in the sport this decade in Jacksonville, before he faces LSU and Kentucky teams that have owned him, before facing an Ole Miss team that's completely revamped its roster and very well could be in the top 10, and before going to Tallahassee, which at best is a coin flip, probably more like 60-40 for FSU of a proposition to win that game. So you're talking about 0-1 before all of that, it no, doesn't look good for him. And you know what? If he loses to Miami, the Texas A&M game 2 weeks later is going to be for his job, which is, by the way, anything but a guarantee that Florida wins that one. So while I look, you know, I won't call for Napier's firing after the Miami game if we lose that, but you lose that Miami game and then you lose to Texas A&M, both in the swamp to start 1-2, that doesn't just put him in a hole. That buries him in a subterranean trench given the schedule that lies ahead. So I'm rooting for him, like I've said multiple times before, but lose to Miami and it just becomes very difficult to objectively imagine a scenario where he survives.
Yeah, I agree. And you go through the schedule early on, there's opportunities to stack wins given the predicaments other teams find themselves in. Yes, look at Miami. They are a slight favorite going into this game, but they're essentially flipping an entire roster of transfers and incoming recruits. And Florida is playing this game at home in the muggy swamp. They'll have home field advantage. This is a game Florida should win. They should pull this out. They have a legitimate chance to win. There are a lot of games where you could say that. Texas A&M, new head coach, new quarterback, playing at home. Mississippi State, while it's on the road, new coach, new quarterback, new roster. A team that you definitely, on an annual basis, have been recruiting better than year in and year out. UCF, similar situation, at home. You recruit better athletes than them on an annual basis. Even Tennessee, you're starting. I understand Nico Imaliava had a great bowl game, finished last year very hot, is a fun pick for the potential Heisman Trophy this year, given his potential, but he's still a freshman quarterback against some veterans on the defensive end for Florida. Florida has gone to Neyland Stadium and has won nearly every time in the last 20 years. That right there is still an opportunity for the Gators to win that game. Kentucky, new quarterback. You go down the list of the schedule, there's opportunities for Florida. Even LSU, new quarterback. Florida State, new quarterback. Right there, those are chances where Florida can strike with opportunity. They have to take advantage of it. And it's not a guarantee that they win any of those games. They could lose all of them. But Florida has a veteran presence at certain positions on the roster, including the quarterback position. And I go back to this a lot now and saying why Florida has a chance to surprise people this year and why some of the people that are a little bit more bullish on Florida, and that is the quarterbacking of Graham Mertz. Graham Mertz had a fantastic season last year, 20 touchdowns to 3 interceptions, nearly 3,000 yards of passing. He would have surpassed that mark if he had not gotten injured against Missouri. This is the most important position on the field. Second year in Napier's system, he has brought in some extra talent. He may be bringing in some more talent around Mertz this coming year. If that offensive line can come together and they can run the football effectively, it's going to give Graham Mertz an opportunity to step back, throw the ball even better than he did last year. And that should result in some wins against some of the rosters we talked about just now in the schedule. So Miami begins that, though, and they will kick off at 3:30. It's going to be a hot one. We're going to be talking about it a lot more over the next 4 months leading up to kickoff, Neil, but exciting nonetheless. And I do expect us to see some more kickoff times announced in the coming weeks, as traditionally the SEC tends to do. So be on the lookout for that. With that, though, want to bring you some extra football news, as we have been talking about the recruitment of Elijah Badger from Arizona State, potential roster upgrades that Napier could be surrounding Graham Mertz with. He is currently, at the time of this recording, on campus. He will be on campus for the next 2 days, going through evaluations, visiting the staff, the school, and seeing if he is a fit at the University of Florida. A lot of Gator fans are excited about the proposition that he could be coming in here. You know, he comes in with over 10 touchdowns, over 1,500 yards of production the last two seasons at Arizona State. Even better the numbers than what Ricky Pearsall came in with when he transferred from Arizona State to Florida. An exciting prospect is nonetheless for the Gators, and could be that extra piece, that missing piece in the offense to replace the production lost by the first rounder, Ricky Pearsall. So we will see if he does indeed commit, if the staff does take him. We'll keep you updated on that as the news potentially does break. So be on the lookout from an All Kinds Weather for that. But he is on campus right now. And as Neil alluded to, in case you missed it from a previous episode, go back and listen to his analysis of whether or not taking Cormani McClain is a good or a bad thing. I think it was a spot on analysis from Neil. Please go back and listen to that if you'd like to hear it. It's about a 30-minute listen or watch. I think it's worth your time. But Cormani McClain is also, for the second time in 1 week, visiting the Gators on another visit. If you were on Instagram earlier today, you could have seen his story with the view screen behind him, Gator chomping in the all-black uniform with the number one and the name commitment on the back. Could it be a sign of things to come? A lot of guys have been potentially alluding to a commitment coming. It's crazy how full circle this has come. This is the world of college football we live in now, but Cormani McClain is on campus along with Elijah Badger, potentially the last two pieces that the Gators add to the roster before the 2024 season. But once again, be on the lookout for that from allkindsofweather.com. We will bring you more shows and content if that news does indeed break. And like I said, go back and listen to Neil's analysis of Cormani McClain and whether or not it is a good or potentially not a good take. But I think Neil nails it. So please go back and listen. All right, Neil, that concludes football. Let's move on to stickball. We're going to start with softball. Softball begins its journey to Oklahoma City, capping off a fantastic run in the SEC tournament this past week at Auburn, Alabama. Honestly, I really think just dominating their way through this tournament. I mean, there really was not a game that was really in doubt too much throughout this tournament. Beating, excuse me, Missouri in the SEC championship game. And they now have earned themselves the number four overall national seed. So, Neil, if you could give the fans a quick summary of this season and how it really has changed from the beginning to where we are now as the number four overall seed.
Yeah, well, so a year ago, the Gator softball team was basically Kendra Falby and Skylar Wallace. And if you got any production from anywhere else, it was a very pleasant surprise. But the statistics throughout the course of the year didn't really indicate that there was anyone else who could produce for them in the clutch. That was all the offense we pretty much had, was those two. Now, though, Florida coach Tim Walton has, a nod to Dabo Swinney, adjusted to the times. He has attacked the transfer portal hard, picking up Jocelyn Erickson from Oklahoma, who, as I've said before, Oklahoma is like what John Wooden's UCLA teams were back in the day, but they made a colossal mistake not finding a place for Jocelyn Erickson on that team. That was, to me, an unbelievable mistake, but they let her go.
Would that be like? Sorry to interrupt, Neil. What kind of an athlete would that be like, just letting walk
football,
away from your
own? In football terms? It's hard because like she's also really good defensively on top of being a big time hitter. So it'd be like, I mean, the low hanging fruit is obviously the level of goats. I won't go there. It'd be like letting for a current team, I guess like a Trey Wilson go. Maybe like historically speaking, like on the goat teams, maybe like a Bubba Caldwell. But if Bubba Caldwell also played safety at a
starter, a massive contributor,
yes,
potentially all conference, all American type athlete.
Yeah. Yes. Not a GOAT, but a very, very good player.
You take them away from that team, they might not win a championship.
Yeah. And look, Oklahoma, this softball this year, still very good. Not what they were the last couple of years. They didn't get the number one overall seed for the first time in several years. And they lost games this year, which, like 2022 and 23, if Oklahoma softball lost a game, it was national news. This year, they lost series. So clearly, Jocelyn Erickson has made a very, very big impact on Florida, as well as simply not being on Oklahoma. Also, Gators getting Corby Otis from Louisville. She has one of the top, I think, three or four batting averages in the country. Pretty good pickup there. You get Wallace and Falby back. They continue to do their things. Well, now Florida has a lineup that can really do damage. You can't just say, okay, well, there's just two players at the top that are going to hurt us. Just get past them and we're fine. No, Florida has more production now throughout 1-9 in its lineup. Also, on the pitching side, Keegan Rothrock and Ava Brown, who's also a solid hitter. Some have called her Baby Hager because she is good at both hitting and pitching. But overall, the profile of this team is one of a team that was much improved from the year before, but until a couple weeks ago, seemed to kind of top out at being a super regional team, maybe sneak into OKC and actually win a game there, but never really be a serious contender to win it all like they were 2 years ago, if you remember that. But then FSU happened. They come to Gainesville and they beat Florida up. Mercy rule, run rule, whatever you want to call it. And since then, Florida's been a different team. They've scored 6 runs in 9 of the last 10 games. They've won 9 of the last 10 games, one of which was a rematch win over FSU in Tallahassee, beat Georgia 3 out of 4 times. And there are still a couple of concerns on defense. Florida does kind of throw the ball away at inopportune times. But overall, you have to love the trajectory that this team has been on since that first FSU loss. They're one of the best 4 teams in the country. Like the selection committee got that right. They're hot. They're playing their best ball at this time of the year. And they're that kind of team you don't want to face in the tournament. And if you're in Oklahoma or Texas or someone else at the top there, you're kind of rooting for other teams to knock them out so you don't have to face them.
And going into the tournament, we were the number 7 team overall in the country. And I remember asking you about this, kind of just not having as much knowledge about the softball scene as you do. I said, okay, well, we've got to be a top 5 seed now because we just won our tournament. And you cautioned me by saying our RPI wasn't as strong as some of the other teams. And you actually look, Missouri, while they weren't as highly ranked, they didn't win the SEC tournament. They ended up with a top 10 seed in the national tournament, but that was because their RPI was very strong. But Florida ended up overcoming that. I think that the committee saw the body of work they put in over the last couple of weeks and then just sweeping through the SEC tournament like it was, you know, it was a cakewalk. And now they do get the number 4 overall seed. They will be facing Florida Gulf Coast in the opening game. And then on the other side of the bracket in the Gainesville Regional is South Alabama and Florida Atlantic, the 2 and 3 seeds respectively. Neil, give us a preview of this regional and the pathway to the Super Regional for the Gators, as if they do end up winning the regional, they potentially could face a familiar foe in Louisiana, who is the 13th national seed.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there's the connection there. Billy Napier used to coach there, but we're not even talking about that. They have former Gator catcher Sam Rowe. They have former Gator pitcher Lexi Delbre. The Gators in Louisiana do recruit a lot of the same athletes, so there's just a lot of common blood there. But Florida, to win the regional, is just going to have to keep getting production from 1 through 9. Examples like Arielle Kowalewski at third base, she's 4 for 9 in her last 5 games. And the reason she only has 9 official at-bats is because she's walked 5 times on top of that, because she has a very, very, very good pair of eyes to understand when the ball is going to kind of tail off and when it's going to rise above her head. So she's a very good piece to have down at the bottom of the lineup. Mia Williams is another example. She has 5 homers all year long. 2 of them came in her last 2 games. Clearly, her eyes are seeing the softball the best that she's seen them all year long. So stuff like that, obviously going to be very helpful to keep going. I really point to Keegan Rothrock for Florida, the freshman pitcher. Since that FSU game, she's pitched 32 innings, allowed just 12 runs. And in doing so, she has dropped her ERA from 2.58 on the year, like 40, 45 games before that. So on the year, in the last 10 games, she's dropped the ERA from 2.58 down to 2.48. So just keep pitching like that and get a little help from Ava Brown here and there. This team could legitimately go on a big run. So the regional for Florida. I mean, no NCAA tournament draw is easy. I want to make that very clear. Nothing is guaranteed. There's no such thing as a cakewalk in the NCAA tournament, or anything can happen. But I think Florida got a tremendously favorable draw here through the regional. I was worried that we would draw Charlotte as our 2 seed or Clemson as our 2 seed. We did not. The selection committee clearly emphasized the regional parity this time around, and that did Florida a huge favor because I think South Alabama got a very generous 2 seed. Their RPI is not in the top 32, and they finished in third place in the Sun Belt. So for a regional 2 seed, that kind of feels like a gift, that that's the best team that's coming here for the regional. That feels like a gift. As a team, they hit just 250, which is 228th in the country. And again, that's in the Sun Belt. And if you're going to beat Florida, you have to hit the ball. You're not going to beat Florida in 1-0 or 2-1 games. Certainly not twice, because obviously double elimination, one game isn't going to kill you. So you certainly can't make a living off of that and knock the Gators out by winning 1-0, 2-1 type games. They do have a good pitching staff, but I think Florida's offense is just too hot for me to put a whole lot of stock into that. So I'm not too worried about that opponent. FAU is the 3 seed. Was one of the last teams in the field. They had a very nervous selection Sunday as they wondered if they'd get in or not. Their numbers for the year are okay, the 2.9 team ERA. hitting exactly 300 on the year. They really struggled against the good teams, and they didn't play that many of them. Arkansas blew them out twice. They had the 100 toughest schedule in the country. They did beat Charlotte 2 out of 3, but Charlotte, I mean, they're a good program. They're not a powerhouse by any means. But you know, solid program, and they finished tied with Charlotte for their American regular season title. Florida should beat them, though. Fun storyline, if you're not already aware, former Florida All-American Elizabeth Hightower, former pitcher for the Gators, actually on staff at FAU. She's a friend of the In All Kinds of Weather brand. I don't want to bash her program too much, but the fact of the matter is FAU was one of the last at-large teams in the field. Florida is one of the hottest teams in the sport right now, especially on offense. Florida should win that matchup, should it come to pass. The last team in there, Gulf Coast, not a terrible regional four seed. They got off to a really bad start, started off 1-5 on the year with some really ugly losses. But to their credit, their pitching stepped up and they made a nice run through the ASUN tournament to win that auto bid. So not an awful four seed, but again, Florida clearly should be victorious should that matchup come to pass, which it will, because they'll start off Friday at noon against Florida Gulf Coast. So if we're talking about this like an NCAA basketball pod, because there the seeds are like more spread out and you can kind of better gauge each team's worth with 16 possible seeds instead of 4, I say obviously Florida is the equivalent of a 1 seed in the regional. South Alabama strikes me as like a 10 or 11 seed. Florida Atlantic is probably also in that range, maybe like 11 or 12, one of those last four in that would have to go through that play-in thing in Dayton. And Florida Gulf Coast is probably a 13 or a 14 as one of the better small conference tournament winners, but still not a team that should be beating Florida. So all in all, anything can happen, nothing guaranteed, but Florida clearly is the best team in this 14 regional and should be the heavy favorite to advance.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. Neil thinks the Gators should have a chance of getting through here and making a long run. We'll be definitely tracking it and updating you all as the tournament goes on. But please make sure to tune in this Friday at noon as the Gators begin their journey to Oklahoma City versus Florida Gulf Coast. Now switching side to another stickball sport, baseball, which unfortunately does not have very similar fortunes to the softball team. Their season has gone in a completely different direction. Gator baseball this past weekend dropped another series to SEC foe, number 4 team in the country, Kentucky Wildcats. Unfortunately, Neil, this is a big loss now. They essentially puts the Gators back against the wall where they must win a series, the Georgia Bulldogs, this coming weekend on the road in order to have a chance to make the tournament, and probably will have to do something in Hoover as well in the SEC tournament. And I think it really just does. We won't spend too much time on this, but what a waste of historic talent, Jack Caglione. He had, a pretty nice message for Gator Nation as he played his final game at Conron Ballpark this past weekend. Pitched, I think, a very good game. Gave the Gators a chance to win that game. Kept them in at the best. Just went cold for the first part of that Sunday game, the rubber match versus Kentucky. They did end up tying the game and then just blew it in extras. But, Neil, I guess instead of maybe dwelling too much on the historic waste, because everybody knows that, what is your fondest memory of Jack Caglione as a Gator? And what do you think his legacy and impact will be on the program?
Well, to me, his legacy is he is the greatest player to come through the Gator baseball program. I mean, there's been no one to hit as many home runs as he has in as short of a period of time. Matt LaPorta, the only guy to ever hit more than Jack Caglione in totality, and he had 4 years to do it. Caglione had like a quarter of the 2022 season and then all of 23 and all of 24. So he basically did it in 2.25 seasons versus LaPorta's 4. Also, by the way, a pretty good pitcher. So there's been no single player to come through this program that has had the impact that Jack Caglione had. As far as a memory, I caught his foul ball with a pretty sweet one-handed grab, if I do say so myself, at that Miami series. It's kind of like Ricky Pearsall'd it or like OBJ'd it, where it was like coming down over my head. I just used 3 fingers. I just like kind of windshield wipers swiped it and like nabbed it on its way down. I'm pretty proud of that myself. But no, the memory that I'm going to always have of him that doesn't involve me for being selfish is the absolute moonshot of 516 feet. Granted, that was against FAMU, but still, to see a ball travel that far, is not something you see every day. So aluminum bat, wood bat, BB core, old school pre-2010 bats, doesn't matter. That's quite a sight to see. So Jack Caglione, it's been a pleasure watching you. We enjoyed having you on the show, and we wish you all the best going forward. And we're sorry that
Absolutely.
the season didn't go any better than it's going.
And we're all hoping and praying that maybe we find a way this week against Georgia and Athens, and we find our way in the NCAA tournament. Because if he does, then he has a chance to break the school record for home runs or for career home runs in a Gator uniform. He would do it in 3 years versus four, like you mentioned, which would be pretty remarkable. And I think my favorite memory for me would probably be the home run he hit against Georgia in response to after the ejection of Brandon Neely. And he just did the uncelebratory walk into the dugout. And I remember, if anybody wants to go back and listen to our episode with Jack before the season started. That would have been in February. It's on our channel. And he does talk a lot about that and what that moment was. So that was just an all-time, like, just great moment where, checkmate, you ejected our best pitcher, but we got you back and scoreboard.
Yeah, we showed up the ump, and we showed up the Georgia Bulldogs by mercy ruling them. And as he said, the ump had to watch him do that because the ump had to watch him cross home plate. So the umpire was literally staring right at him, and there's no way that Brian DeBrower, the umpire that day, did not take note of what happened. So that was sweet. It was so uncelebratory that it was celebratory.
Yeah. All right, Neil. I think that about does it. I don't know if you have anything else to add here, but I think that this was a good episode, just kind of giving the fans an update on our football program, the kickoff ahead for the season against Miami. We'll see you in the swamp at 3:30. And then let's tune into softball this weekend. And then also the Georgia series where the Gators fight for NCAA tournament berth.